This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, and you know the movie I'm talking about, the one that everybody said, you gotta see it. It's got 5 stars. It's up for an Oscar, maybe 3 Oscars. There have been endless think pieces. You buy the ticket, you walk into the theater, and of course you hated it. What were the critics thinking? This thing is awful. Today on Movies on the Radio, we dedicate an hour to your picks for the most overrated films. Our movie experts take on everything from, yes, Forrest Gump, to the desperately romantic Titanic. Oh, and much, much more. Movie experts Laura Boys and Marcia Gordon are with us in the studio. Marcia is a film professor at NC State. Laura is the film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Welcome back.
Thank you.
We're ready to go.
We are.
Some people would say our whole show, The State of Things, overrated. But it's not true because, frankly, no one has ever said it's any good. So it's not overrated. This brings us to the question, though. What do we mean by overrated? Because we're not necessarily saying bad movies, right? We're saying, I mean, a lot of them on this list are. But the fact is, overrated is different than just plain bad.
Well, I think there's 2 levels of kind of what we think of the criteria for being overrated. One is the critical establishment. So everyone is raving about this in their reviews, and it's getting nominated for awards, and it has a kind of professional industrial recognition. And the other is the popular, killing at the box office. Everyone's talking about it. Everyone's saying you have to see it. It's the best thing ever. And so some kind of combination of one or the other of, you know, or one of those being very outsized in favor of a film, I think warrants the moniker of being overrated.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that I love about the movie is that it's completely democratic, small d, meaning that people who go to an art museum or a symphony concert or the opera, and they might hesitate to express their opinion because they feel they're not well informed enough and, you know, they need more background. But everybody has an opinion about the movie that they've seen the instant that they've seen it. And I say everyone's opinion is valid. I'm not going to hate on your movies if you don't hate on my movies. Everybody's entitled to their own likes and dislikes.
But the reality is people love to have the debate about, no, that was not a good movie. That was terrible. This is a wonderful movie. And what's interesting about this topic is that this is the first time we've really done one that asks people to kind of take a film down a little bit and say, look, maybe it doesn't deserve to be in the place that it is in our film.
And actually, I once broke up with a boy in college because he loved a movie so much that I thought was complete and utter dreck.
Do we get 3 guesses?
You'll never guess what movie this is.
We have a surprise for you, Laura. Let's go to the phone.
It was her name.
Well, what was the movie?
Performance starring Mick Jagger.
Oh, you hated that movie?
Listen, let's go to the phones now and talk to our listeners, because part of it, too, is the amount of money that gets spent.
When I was 18, Marcia. Okay.
Let's go over this tape.
I'm Morgan Weston from Durham, North Carolina, and my pick for most overrated film is Avatar.
The concept is to drive these remotely controlled bodies called avatars. They're grown from human DNA mixed with DNA of the natives.
Marine in an avatar body. That's a potent mix.
You get me what I need, I'll see to it you get your legs, babe. Your real legs.
Hell yeah, sir.
Looks like you. This is your avatar.
Just relax and let your mind go blank. It shouldn't be hard for you.
Very pretty to look at, and it's very beautiful and very technologically advanced for the time that it was released. But overall, it was, in my opinion, a huge waste of resources and of my time personally watching it. You don't really get any kind of strong connection to the characters, which I think is evidenced in the fact that there is no big cultural following of this movie, as there is with some of the other higher grossing films out there, Harry Potter, X-Men, Star Wars especially comes to mind. And also, I mean, it was just very emotionally manipulative and kind of didn't really take you anywhere. It felt like watching Disney's Pocahontas with blue people pretty much down to every single plot point.
The 2009 James Cameron film Avatar, which was like a gazillion dollars to make.
Well, yeah, I mean, that question of resources is, I think, one that's going to come up a number of times today, because there are these films that get talked about before they're released. The most expensive film ever made, more money put into this. And in this case, this was the special effects extravaganza. And I remember seeing it and thinking, this is fine, but I'm never going to think about this film again. Right. And in point of fact, until this came up today, right, I have not thought about the film since I've seen it, which is, I think, saying something about its forgettableness in terms of the story, character, like the caller was saying.
Yeah. And the thing that I love the most about the movies are actors. And once a movie turns into a cartoon, unless it's explicitly a cartoon, I just completely lose interest in
it. Live action animation.
All the CGI people, I can't bring myself to care.
And yet there are also those animated films that are so human by virtue of their ability to kind of create these characters
that have their emotions,
exactly. So this is a case of like the worst of both worlds in some ways.
So Avatar had no afterlife. Here's a film that had quite an afterlife, but still a number of people said, I don't get it.
I'm Marty Jarrell, and I live in Durham, North Carolina. My pick for most overrated film is 2001, A Space Odyssey. And I'm a little embarrassed because it's such a cultural icon, and everybody loves the film, and it influenced so many other films, but I've never been able to get through it. I find it completely unwatchable. The pacing is so painfully slow, and the music, while on its own is a beautiful piece of music, it's so over the top. It just makes me laugh. And, you know, I can put up with some bad special effects. I have a lot of old classic films that I love, but the apes in this film are just ridiculous. It's embarrassing to all primates everywhere. So I've never been able to get through it. I know basically what it's about because it's so much a part of our culture now, but it's just terrible, and I don't understand why everyone loves it.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
What are you talking about, Hal?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
I don't know what you're talking about, Hal.
I know that you and Frank were planning to disconnect me. And I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
1968 sci-fi classic 2001, A Space Odyssey.
The pacing for this movie is extremely slow, and it's sort of meant to reproduce the way people actually move in space. There's a lot of silence. It takes a lot of patience. But the way I saw it first, which was in 70 millimeter in a gigantic theater where it becomes an all-involving sensual experience. That's what this was made for. It was not really meant to be watched on TV.
Laura Boyes and Marcia Gordon on this edition of Movies on the Radio today on The State of Things. Marcia?
There's a coldness to this film, right? That this is not a film where you feel warm and fuzzy about characters. But what this film has, just to answer in a kind of broad sense, and I'm not the biggest defender in the entire world of 2001, it has ideas, and it has pretty amazing ideas. And I think that's the thing that allows it to kind of earn its place. How many people understand the concept of like HAL and what it means, even if they haven't seen the film? This is an idea that's so potent that it kind of circulates in our culture and has kind of resonance and meaning.
And it doesn't really have a satisfying ending, which is another thing that people find troubling.
No, but it raises questions, and I think this theme will come up over and over in this particular hour, which is if you have a big idea, and it's an important one, and HAL, the idea is still with us, and it's still used now. In fact, more now when we talk about AI than even back then when it was considered almost preposterous that the machine to take over. So it's one thing to have a nice idea, but then to spend 3 hours just dragging us through it is how are you going to express this idea? This
a lot of these movies are very long. I think we should also mention that.
That's the other thing. All right, let's get to one more quick that is a bit of a surprise.
Hi, this is Grant Steen calling from Durham. I'm calling to complain particularly about Citizen Kane, which irks me no end.
Rosebud.
It is not that good a movie, and yet everyone loves it. And I think the reason that they love it is because of the last 30 seconds. The whole rest of the movie is cold and analytical and uninvolving, and the last 30 seconds or a minute is like the sentimental tripe sort of thumbtacked on the end of the movie. And I think everybody leaves with a warm, mushy feeling because of that ending, but it doesn't really have much to do with the rest of the movie.
If you could have found out what that rosebud meant, I bet that would have explained everything.
No, I don't think so. No. Mr. Kane was a man who got everything he wanted and then lost it. Maybe Rosebud was something he couldn't get or something he lost. Anyway, it wouldn't have explained anything. I don't think any word can explain a man's life. No, I guess Rosebud is just a piece in a jigsaw puzzle.
1941, classic Citizen Kane.
Yeah, I'm going to have to take this one on.
Right.
So first I'm going to tell a story on myself, which is I first saw this film when I was probably 18, and I got to the end. I'm going to have a spoiler alert moment, so turn off your radios. If you haven't seen it, it's a sled, okay? And I got to that point, and I said, are you kidding me? Yeah. This is a movie about a sled? I was 18. And so since then, of course, I've had some years and time to watch it and rewatch it, and it is a magnificent film that is filled with layers and complexity, and it is stunning. Visually, it's stunning in terms of the way that it tries to kind of narrate what makes a man, what makes a life, and the sled and the sentimental last few moments to me have nothing to do with it. They could be gone. That's the kind of throwaway. So I think that in some ways that's missing the point of the film.
Yeah, but if you get there, well, let's take a break here. We'll come back. We can talk more about it because part of it is, and I think for some viewers who didn't like films that were iconic in many ways, it's that it didn't work for them. That somehow the punchline, that the movie didn't earn that ending or whatever it was. We'll talk more about it. Overrated movies. Marcia Gordon, film professor at NC State. Laurel Boyes, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Overrated films. The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Movies on the radio, your most overrated film, the one everybody told you you should see, and then you hated everybody afterward because you saw it. Marcia Gordon, film professor at NC State. Laurel Boyes, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Citizen Kane.
Well, it also had extremely revolutionary storytelling as far as its flashbacks within flashbacks. As Marcia said, visually it was revolutionary with a kind of deep focus photography that allowed you to see the psychological layers actually portrayed on the screen. And it was very topical at the time as well because everyone knew who William Randolph Hearst was. He tried to get the film banned, which of course created a huge amount of interest in it. And if it seems kind of ho-hum now, it's because every movie since Citizen Kane has stolen from it.
Let's go to another one right here.
Hi, my name is Peter Hasselberg, calling from Henderson, North Carolina. My choice for overrated movie was The Big Lebowski, just because, you know, I was watching it and I felt like I was kept waiting for this catharsis or payoff at the finale. And while like the individual parts of it all seemed great, like this weird situation, this quest for his rug that got peed on or all of that, all these brilliant characters in between, like I felt like it never came together at the end. And I was waiting for, you know, what's the finale? What's the catharsis here? And, you know, at the end, Sam Elliott's character comes out and says, you know, I'm not sure what all of this means, but there you go. And I'm like, well, I feel the same way, Sam Elliott. You know, I'm not sure what all of this means. And it's strange because, you know, the movie was clearly being exactly the movie it wanted to be. And you can't fault it for that, but I still don't get it. And I see these books at bookstores, like the philosophy of the dude in The Big Lebowski.
Are you employed, Mr. Lebowski?
Wait, let me explain something to you. I am not Mr. Lebowski. You're Mr. Lebowski. I'm the dude. So that's what you call me, you know? That or his dudeness or duder or, you know, El Duderino, if you're not into the whole brevity thing.
Are you employed, sir?
Employed?
I'm in the minority, but I had at least one film professor who agreed with me. He said, you know, the joy of this film eludes me.
1998, The Big Lebowski.
I'm afraid that Peter might be looking for catharsis in the wrong film. yeah, this film to me, I mean, this is a matter of personal taste, is it not? I mean, to me, it is a brilliant, hilarious romp. And I just, every time I see this movie, I get a tremendous joy and pleasure out of it. And it's Hollywood jokes, and it's just kind of take on the absurdity of life. And so I really appreciate it.
And it's also a parody of film noir. And film noir doesn't necessarily have the most coherent plots, and it's all the atmosphere and the characters and what actually happens in the movie is sometimes
it's
secondary.
It's true. I'm still waiting to understand what happens in The Big Sleep, no matter how many times I've watched
Nobody
that film.
Knew, Nobody even the people knew. Who made it.
And so, yeah, so it's yeah. it is one of those films. And because it is taken off so much as a cult film, I think there is this sense of it as a kind of sacred text. But I don't think it's the same way as, say, Citizen Kane.
And I do not think it was well reviewed when it came out.
No, I think that's right.
I think that it was something that... that built up over time.
Don't you think? I think there's a theme that runs through, or a thread that runs through some of the complaints about these films and some of the films, which is that they have that embodiment of a certain comic effect. In this case, it is the slacker dude, who inherently is just irritating. And so I call it the Colbert effect. Either you get that they're, you know, you feel, and I get that he understands it's a joke, but if you feel that that has turned and you see the comedy in it, it's great. Otherwise, you're just being irritated by a slacker dude for 90 minutes.
Right.
Yeah, and that can have, that's happened in a couple of these films. Why don't we move on to our next film right here?
This is Stephen Goldstein. I'm calling from Asheville. The film that I think is probably the most overrated that I've ever encountered was Peter Greenaway's The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover. This is a film that was very highly rated by pretty much every critic around at the time. And as a consequence, I got suckered into seeing it with some friends. I felt that it was offensive on almost any level, from the opening credits, where you witness from across the street from the restaurant where a lot of the action takes place, the beating and rubbing of dog excrement onto one of the characters, to the incredibly brutal murder of the lover in the title. I couldn't think of any reason why this film was even made, really. Such a loathsome plot. Utterly repellent characters, none of whom did I find myself having any sympathy for.
Get rid of that!
Don't do that to a woman!
I do what I like to a woman!
That's your bloody trouble. No wonder Georgie looks like she does. No wonder she hates your guts.
What are you talking about?
No wonder she screws around.
What?
You're so bloody blind, you loudmouth pig, you'd never even notice.
Shut up, Pat! She's waving.
I'm not, I saw them.
It's all right.
Georgie and that bloke who sits over there. They always go off to the John together.
You what?
Why do you think George has been spending so much time in the John? You blind bat. She doesn't have the shits every 5 minutes.
And it didn't feel like there was anything to either learn from it, gain from it, or certainly be entertained by it.
1989, The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover.
So this is a film by Peter Greenaway, and I think it's the only film we'll talk about today that's really an art film. Okay, so this is not the same as talking about The Big Lebowski or even 2001. And this is, first off, all-star cast. It's Helen Mirren, Michael Gambon, Tim Roth. I absolutely appreciate this viewer's revulsion about the film. It is about revolting characters who do grotesque and awful things. It's sadistic, etc. But I think formally, I haven't seen the film in a long time, but this was a favorite of mine in college when I was kind of getting into film and understanding form and aesthetics, and it's a very, very rich film, but I absolutely understand this is not a film that's for everyone.
Is it a film that you would have to know a lot about film and film history to really appreciate? Otherwise, it's just men beating
it
women.
It has naked Helen Mirren, Frank, so.
Well, there's that. There's a lot of women getting beaten around and forks in their faces and stuff that's really nasty.
There's a lot of violence in film, and there's a lot of violence in film towards women. And this is a film about a particularly repugnant character who gets his comeuppance in a very real way at the film's end. So I just think it's not a film for everyone.
Well, one of my friends, in fact, said to me, I wish there were things in this film that I could unsee. So I never have seen it, because to me, that is the ultimate not for me kind of comment.
Yeah, and again, it's one of these questions about whether or not you can see how the film reflects on the violence or whether the violence is just in your face. And that's, again, you know, one of these questions that I think are a recurring theme. Speaking of violence in films you don't like,
yes.
Laura, your pick?
Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
Because
I just heard there was a gasp. 40,000 people.
Let me just say,
there was a gasp in the booth.
There were probably, I mean, I lied about seeing this movie for about 10 years before I actually saw it because I knew I wasn't going to like it. And, you know, I can appreciate, you know, the retro vibe, the killer soundtrack, the motor mouth dialogue, the excellent performances. But for me, the over-the-top violence in Quentin Tarantino has absolutely no justification, especially because I am told over and over again in no uncertain terms that that is art and my romantic melodrama is not art. And I say you cannot make those kinds of distinctions.
Now, did you lie and say that you liked it or didn't like it for all those years?
I just kept my mouth shut and pretended that I'd seen it when people were discussing it.
Well, there certainly is a kind of matter-of-fact treatment. And not only do we see graphically the gore and the violence, but then there's a kind of matter-of-fact treatment about it all.
Okay, first step, you two. Take the body, stick it in the trunk. Now, Jimmy, this looks to be a pretty domesticated house. That would lead me to believe that in the garage you're under the sink, you got a bunch of cleaners and cleansers, shit like that.
Yeah, yeah, Mr. Wolf, under the sink.
Good. All you two fellas to do is take those cleaning products and clean the inside of the car. I'm talking fast, fast, fast. You need to go in the back seat, scoop up all those little pieces of brain and skull, get it out of there. Wipe down the upholstery. Now, when it comes to upholstery, you don't need to be spick and span. You don't need to eat off it. Just give it a good once-over. What you need to take care of are the really messy parts. The pools of blood that I've collected, you gotta soak that shit up. We need to camouflage the interior of the car. We're gonna line the front seat and the back seat and the floorboards with quilts and blankets. So if a cop stops us and starts sticking his big snout in the car, the subterfuge won't last. But at a glance, the car will appear to be normal. Jimmy, lead the way. Boys, get to work.
Please, would be nice.
If I'm curt with you, it's because time is a factor. I think fast, I talk fast, and I need you guys to act fast if you want to get out of this. So pretty please, with sugar on top, clean the f***ing car.
Quentin Tarantino's 1994 crime film, Pulp Fiction.
Well, it's interesting because I know for Laura, violence is a dividing line for you. And for me, fictional violence doesn't bother me almost all the time. I mean, violence in the real world I have a real problem with, but in film it does not. But I appreciate that that is something that some people just don't have any patience for and don't want to see. And this is a film that, I mean, it really took the world by storm, right? I mean, it really created a tidal wave of critical acclaim, audience acclaim, imitations, a style, a Tarantino-esque style that emerged fairly quickly. And so I do think this film kind of deserves its place for what it is, which is a style maker, change maker, taste maker, that kind of film.
Right. And I love how much Quentin Tarantino loves the movies and attempts to filter all these genre films through his own aesthetic. It's just like, I need to see the airplane version. That's all.
Right.
Well, here's a film that probably could have used a shotgun or two, according to at least one listener.
My name is Howard DeBose, and I am calling from Bushy Fork, North Carolina. My least favorite overrated movie is a film by Louis Malle called My Dinner with Andre. Even though I generally like Louis Malle films, this particular one was very boring.
Okay, yes, we are bored. We're all bored now. But has it ever occurred to you, Wally, that the process that creates this boredom that we see in the world now may very well be a self-perpetuating, unconscious form of brainwashing created by a world totalitarian government based on money, and that all of this is much more dangerous than one thinks, and it's not just a question of individual survival, Wally, but that somebody who's bored is asleep, and somebody who's asleep will not say no?
I especially did not like the actor who played Andre. I thought he looked and sounded like a weasel. I know that Roger Ebert gave this a very high rating as like the best film of the year, but I have a degree in film and television, so I spent a lot of time watching movies like this and reading Roger Ebert, and on this one, I just do not agree with him. I think it was a terrible film. I do hope that no one else has to suffer through watching this film. I'm very glad that they made money on it, but I'm sorry that they made money off of me.
There you go. My Dinner with Andre, 1981.
Well, when I first saw this film in 1981, it was different. It was kind of captivating. There was a lot of critical acclaim.
It's two guys sitting down talking, right?
It's just talking. And then my daughter came home from college, and she says, all my college friends really love this movie. We have to watch it. And we watched about, I don't know, maybe not even half an hour, and we just looked at each other, and we said, this is terrible. And Adrian said, on top of it, Andre Gregory, who's an actual experimental theater director, she said, this is what all my friends talk about all the time. This is like being in school. I have no interest in this whatsoever. So we just turned it off and went on to something else.
Even Roger Ebert could be wrong sometimes. Yeah. I mean, this is a film that I think just reeks of this kind of pretension that it should even exist, that is very easy to take umbrage with. So I feel like, yeah, this is a film I've never understood. The great, I mean, there are people who are ferociously passionate about this film. It's brilliant, it's deep, it's thought-provoking, and I see it as all kind of surface and pretense.
But again, one of these things, your interpretation of this film in its form, in other words, we expect films to have action, we expect them to have a plot line, a beginning, and so what this film does is it takes that expectation, turns it on its head, and forces us to think about the big deal. I mean, you can understand how someone might, not me, but you can understand how someone might come to that conclusion and see this as a kind of meta message about filmmaking.
Except I love slow, patient, right. Plotless films. When they're done well, this to me, I mean, this one just did not do it for me at all.
Why do you think, why do you suppose it got the critical acclaim that it did then? What was going on?
Because it was so different.
Different, yeah. So it upends the form.
And it's a little time capsule of New York at a certain day and time, and I don't know.
It's just two guys talking.
It's mostly
monologuing.
That.
It's mostly right. Andre right. monologuing.
Right. You're listening to three people talking on Movies on the Radio today on The State of Things. Today, your picks for the most overrated movies.
My name is Ed Butler. I'm calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. And my pick for most overrated film is the movie The Lobster. I really don't even know what to say about this thing. It's supposed to be a dark comedy. There's nothing funny about it. It's ridiculously dark. And it's nothing redeeming. None of the characters are redeeming. Everybody, the singles, the married, everyone, just horrible people.
Have you thought about what animals you want to be if you don't make it?
A lobster.
I'm going to be a parrot. If I don't make it, why don't you become parrots too? And then we'll all be together.
You're a complete idiot, picking one of the few animals that can talk when you have a speech impediment. You'll lisp even as an animal. As for you, they'll catch you and put you in a pot of boiling water until you die. And then they'll crack open your claws with a tool, like pliers, and they'll suck out what little flesh you have with their mouths. You're pathetic, both of you.
The cast are great. I love the actors, especially, I gotta say, I got to do a shout out for Olivia Colman because I love her. She was excellent in Broadchurch, one of the greatest things ever. But this movie, The Lobster, oh, please.
2015.
Yes.
The Lobster.
So this was just, this film came out a year or two ago, and it's this dystopian sci-fi film, dark comedy about having to find a mate within a short period of time. And I have to admit, I was a little puzzled by why this film got so much acclaim. There were some interesting parts of it, but to me, it didn't feel like a great film.
Well, part of any movie, you have to say, who is it that is giving the movie acclaim? I always look, you know, a pull quote on the
right.
on the TV, you know, greatest movie ever made. It's like, you have to read the small print and see who's actually saying that.
And it's also useful sometimes to read the full sentence or the full paragraph from which it came, because right. often those are pulled from much larger, more critical reviews.
Don't you think a part of what's going on here, because I noticed that some of the complaints about films had to do with later, more contemporary films than the earlier ones, and most of those had characters who were somehow sociopathic in their lack of affect. And that's one of the themes that comes through in the later films, which is more common to contemporary life. I mean, if you think about the 30s and 40s, smart talk, smart Alex and quick talk was kind of, that was a colorful character and everybody wanted to put that character in a movie. Well, even if there is no plot, the characters are fun to follow. If the character of today is a slacker, is somebody who has some kind of antipathy, not particularly socially graceful, you know, 90 minutes of that's pretty rough to take.
Yeah, well, and that's absolutely true. Yeah. And I think that having characters with whom you can identify and stories that you can relate to and want to be a part of, that makes it much easier to kind of go along with the world of the film. But, you know, actually, I'm looking at the films that we've talked about even so far. I mean, surely Pulp Fiction is a very strong character-driven
film. Well, and Laura Boys is the only human in America who doesn't like it. So that's
I'm not recanting.
But the ones that where you've got a lot of folks, I mean, maybe not even a majority, but a number of people in 2001 say, you know what, I get that it was a great film, but it took a long time to end.
Well, the other thing is people go to the movies for a lot of different reasons, right? That's the reality. That's the beauty of it, right? It's not all, some people will never see a horror film. Some people will see every horror film that comes out. And so everyone's looking for something different. Do you want to get scared? Do you want to laugh? Do you want all of it? I mean, and so I think part of when you're talking about critical reception, I mean, there are films that tend to kind of get acclaim that kind of move in these circles that has nothing to do necessarily with the way the vast majority of the public is going to perceive or think about them. And that happens at a level from festivals and preview screenings. It happens on a critical level, and then it kind of filters down. And so there's often some tension between those things.
Movies are like a box of chocolates.
Oh.
Forrest Gump is next. Yes, it is. Marcia Gordon, film professor at NC State, Laura Boys, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Overrated films coming up. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Movies on the Radio, running through your picks for the most overrated films with Laura Boys from the North Carolina Museum of Art and Marcia Gordon from North Carolina State University. This one is going to, I think, provoke a few gasps.
Hi, my name is Lucy Inman, and I'm calling from Raleigh. At the top of my list has got to be Forrest Gump. I came out of the film feeling manipulated and disappointed in the director. We know that Forrest is a different person. I've known many people in my life who have developmental disabilities or other differences. And rather than setting a scene that would encourage regular people to embrace folks who have differences, this film seemed to tell us that Forrest was magical. And that when something happened to Forrest, it was so completely over the top, along with a musical score to tell us how to feel when we saw a scene that should already have been endearing without the music. It really made Forrest not seem like a real person.
Hey, stupid!
Quit it! Run, Forrest, run!
Hey, did you hear me, stupid?
Run, Forrest!
Get the truck, get the truck, move it!
Run, Forrest! Run!
And he did. Very fast. 1994, Forrest Gump.
So I just remember groaning out loud during this film. I had so little patience for it. And my story about this is I saw it. I finally made myself go see it. And then I got on a plane a week later to fly to California. And it was the movie on the plane. And I will do anything to pass the time on a flight, and I opted not to watch it. Let me just say, like, I was like, I would rather sit and stare at my shoes for 2.5 hours rather than watch this again.
Some people love this film.
Okay, so I watched this last week, and it seemed very different to me now than it did before. To me, it looked like an 18th century picaresque novel where a naive character wanders from episodic adventure to episodic adventure. And Forrest was the naive, straight arrow, good-hearted part of America, and his girlfriend, played by Robin Wright, is the broken heart of America, and they have to come together to heal the country. I mean, that.
Wow, that's a lot that you got from that film.
And
does that make it any better or worse?
Bottom line is,
yeah,
they should have given the Oscar to Robert Zemeckis for Back to the Future, and instead they gave it to him for this movie. I could not hate it. There were things that were incredibly annoying and unnecessary, but I could not hate it the way people do.
When it came out, the New York Times reviewer, I think it was Janet Maslin, I could be wrong, said that it was less like a kind of a romance or a movie than it was like a coffee table book of special effects. And so I think that speaks to that idea of it being overdetermined by this trickery that's like the gimmick of the film.
And that is the most annoying part of it. But to me, that was just like a throwaway gag. It wasn't, to me, the main thing.
Yeah. Well, and even with the picaresque, they were at least rascals, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And this guy's sweeter than can be.
Right. He is very sweet. That's
all
true.
Right, Marcia. Time has come. Tell us about your... Talk about gas. Wait
okay.
until...
So... First off, there is, as we've been talking about, personal film reactions versus more critical. And so I would say I can divide my feelings between my personal relationship to film and my film historical appreciation. Mm-hmm. So one of the most often viewed and beloved films touted by the studio, as well as by a lot of critics and audiences when it came out and to this day is the greatest motion picture ever when it was released in 1939 is Gone with the Wind.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, of course, the nearly four-hour Civil War epic.
Yeah.
Does it have merits? Absolutely. I'm not saying this is the worst film ever made, most terrible film. The Technicolor's gorgeous, the costumes, the kind of narrative arc, you could say it's kind of interesting. But I think that the romance between Scarlett and Rhett, kind of set against the pageantry of the whole plantation life thing, is not compelling. I find Rhett Butler to be patronizing and creepy. The romanticization of these kind of docile, contented slaves I find to be offensive and galling. And to me, it's not just about imposing a contemporary view on it. This is just not a film that resonates with me.
Let's listen to a clip.
But, Red, I really can't go on accepting these gifts, though you are awfully kind.
I'm not kind. I'm just tempting you. I never give anything without expecting something in return. I always get paid.
Well, if you think I'll marry you, just pay for the bonnet. I won't.
Don't flatter yourself. I'm not a marrying man.
Well, I won't kiss you for it either.
Open your eyes and look at me. No, I don't think I will kiss you. Although you need kissing badly. That's what's wrong with you. You should be kissed and often, and by someone who knows how.
Oh, and I suppose you think you are the proper person.
I might be, if the right moment ever came.
You're a conceited, black-hearted vomit, Red Butler, and I don't know why I let you come and see me.
I'll tell you why, Scarlett. Because I'm the only man over 16 and under 60 who's around to show you a good time.
1939,
so, yeah, bottom line, I just don't think that this is a film that deserves the enthusiastic adoration heaped upon it, especially when I think about the Academy Awards of this year, which it swept. And there were so many other amazing films. Ninotchka, which you'll be showing this summer at the Carolina Theater, Stagecoach, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Wizard of Oz, films that I think are so much richer and more interesting in so many ways. And so there it is.
Well, this was a film that I really loved when I was about 12 years old, and I memorized the dialogue, and I mean, I loved it as a little Yankee girl growing up in Ohio, and when I watched it again a few years ago, I could still say all the dialogue. I was like, no, yeah. This is so awful, so awful from a political point of view, although the one thing that is very daring about it is that Scarlett O'Hara is one of the most unlikable women that has ever been on film. She is an incredible anti-heroine, and you're supposed to admire her grit and her fortitude, but stay out of her way because there isn't anything that's appealing about her.
All right. Well, and by the way, it's long.
It's really
long. That's the
long.
The last thing I noticed about that film is how long it was. Let's go on.
Hi, my name is Margaret Shucker. I'm calling from Raleigh, North Carolina, and my nominee for the worst, most overrated film I've ever seen is The Grand Budapest Hotel. It was absolutely beautiful. The music was wonderful, but I never felt anything for any of the characters. There were so many big stars in the movie, but I never felt any interaction among them.
I'm not leaving.
I beg your pardon?
I'm not leaving.
Why not?
I'm frightened.
Of what?
I fear this may be the last time we ever see each other.
Why on earth would that be the case?
Well, I can't put it into words, but I feel it.
Well, for goodness sake, there's no reason for you to leave us if you'd rather...
Come with me.
To Lutz.
Please.
Give me your hand. You've nothing to fear. You're always anxious before you travel. I admit you appear to be suffering a more acute attack on this occasion, but truly and honestly... Oh, dear God, what have you done to your fingernails?
I beg your pardon?
This diabolical varnish, the colour is completely wrong.
Oh, really? Don't you like it?
It's not that I don't like it. I am physically repulsed.
Analogy is that it was like a beautiful box of chocolates, and when you took one out and bit it, it was full of sawdust. I remember watching it and looking at my watch every 10 minutes to see how much longer I had to suffer through this.
Grand Budapest Hotel must have been one of Forrest Gump's chocolates. 2014, that film was made.
Well, I feel very sad about this because I really love Wes Anderson. Yeah. He's extremely stylized. He's a really unique filmmaker who makes film entirely to his own taste. He doesn't really care about other people liking his films. He certainly doesn't care if they sell a lot of ticket in China or wherever the international markets that blockbusters are aimed at. And, you know, some of his films are better than others, mm-hmm. but I admire his unique artistry.
Well, and I think the people who love Wes Anderson love him because he makes these quirky, precious worlds. And people who hate Wes Anderson hate him because he makes these quirky, precious worlds. And this is an absolute question of taste. Yeah. And I mean, you either kind of buy into it and admire the kind of meticulous set pieces and all of the symmetry and all of the things about an Andersonian film, or you just go, "Why? I don't get it."
Yeah, and those are quirky, and they're certainly of a piece and of a kind. And then there are the blockbusters that you either love or hate.
Hi, I'm Ellen O'Hara Slavik from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and one of the most overrated films, in my opinion, is Titanic. And it was one of those movies that I almost had to get up and walk out of, which I don't think I've ever really done. Or maybe I had to do it once for the Blair Witch Project because it actually made me nauseous with the handheld camera. But I just hated this film because it was completely schlocky and saccharine and melodramatic. And the image I have in my head is of Rose at the head of the boat with Jack just repeating over and over, "Rose, Rose," or something like that, with the horrible Celine Dion song playing in the background. And I normally like Kate Winslet. I think she's a great actress, but I was disappointed that she agreed to star in a movie that really reflects nothing of the reality of the situation of the people on the Titanic at that time in history. It was just a Hollywood blockbuster with no profound meaning.
1997, the Titanic was made, or at least that one.
Well, once again, I'm sad to hear this. I also invested another 3 hours last week in watching this film as well. Yes, the romance is sappy. The dialogue is pretty awful. But
the popcorn was good.
You know, Leo and Kate, they're like teenagers. They're full of such energy and passion. And James Cameron really sunk a ship. It's one of the last movies that really had those kind of practical effects where you see, you know, what it would have been like, because they didn't actually know how the Titanic had sunk until they found the wreckage. So they were able to reproduce the way it went down. And I mean, I think, you know, what would I have done on the Titanic? I mean, it really sort of brings you into... And you're smirking at me!
I'm sorry,
but
I can't.
But once again, it's like using the word melodrama as a pejorative word. I mean, melodrama is a universal emotion. This was a worldwide blockbuster because everybody wanted to experience the romance and the tragedy.
All I have to say is Gone with the Wind on a big boat. But in all seriousness, I can't believe I forgot that Celine Dion song. I mean, that's hard to believe because who could? It was everywhere. That song was in a very offensive part of the marketing strategy for this film.
But I think it was only over the ending credits. I don't think it was actually.
I'm talking about in the culture. I'm talking about every time you walked into a doctor's office, an elevator, turned the radio on in the car. But, I mean, obviously the set and the costumes, I mean, there were some things that were notable about this film. And this was one of those biggest budget, most expensive movie ever made. And I know a lot of people who were like, can we please sink that ship? It's going so slow.
Okay, well, I'll go to Titanic while you go to Pulp Fiction. That's fair.
Just trying to keep things even today on Movies on the Radio on the State of Things. Today, it's your picks for most overrated films.
I'm Rick Larrick. I'm calling from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. My pick is Moonrise Kingdom. It had a great critical reputation. It was praised for how charming and sweet it was. But when I watched it, it just seemed completely simple-minded. It was as if it were a cartoon with very little plot. And I was getting madder and madder as I was watching it, but I was there with friends and family, and I was in disbelief that they weren't ready to walk out of the theater. And so I put up with the whole movie, and I think the thing that drove me most crazy was how big the names of the stars were and how little they were doing on the screen.
What kind of bird are you?
I'm a sparrow. She's a dove.
No, I said, what kind of bird are you?
I'm a raven.
Boys aren't allowed in here.
I'll be leaving soon. What happened to your hand?
I got hit in the mirror.
Really? How did that happen?
I lost my temper at myself. What's your name?
Sam, what's yours?
I'm Susie.
It's not polite to stare.
Birds, ready. Who are you? Where did you come from? Go back to your seat.
He likes you.
Moonrise Kingdom from 2012, another Wes Anderson film.
I know. I felt so sad that Wes Anderson came up twice on this list, especially because I really love Moonrise Kingdom. This is a film that's so sympathetic towards kids and is really trying to imagine kids in this frustrating, difficult period of their lives. And I find it incredibly charming, and I love the universe. So I'm sorry that Rick didn't like it.
Yeah, I feel the same.
But here's the thing. Now, this is, again, one of those films where the charm is in the muted affect of a child. And you can see that in both in most of the kids, particularly the principal players here. And so if you watch children mumble, which is the point of it, it gets to be kind of cloying over time. I think that's what I felt, that this kind of being like that and understanding that that's your problem because the world is oppressing you. That's a good, I get it. And that story should be told. 90 minutes of that, kind of rough.
Yeah, I disagree.
No, that's the point. That's exactly it. It's what I call the Colbert effect. Either you feel the turn, the
not
satire.
The Colbert.
No, the
Colbert
effect.
I had a minute.
He doesn't do that show anymore, unfortunately. But when he did the Colbert Report, there was that notion that, you know, here's the guy who's actually doing that to and he turns it by a quarter and you get the comedy. And if you don't see the quarter turn, you think, what an irritating fellow is he. What should we do next time? Oh, it's May.
It is May.
Should we do moms?
I think doing moms is a great, in honor of Mother's Day.
In honor of Mother's Day next month.
A boy's best friend is his mother.
Aw. Well, I love my mom, and I know that films about mothers would make a great topic for Movies on the Radio, so that's what we want to hear from next on Movies on the Radio. Films about motherhood, moms, you name it. You know how to reach us, State of Things, WNC at stateofthings.org. Marcia Gordon, Laura Boys, Marcia, film professor at NC State. Laura Boys, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Mothers on the Radio. Mothers and film on the radio.
This show is exhausting, Frank. All this emotion.
But it's genuine. It comes from the heart. Stateofthings.org is where you can find this melodramatic emotion where it will live forever. Anita Rao is one of our producers, as well as Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is the technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Station.